From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It appears that for news about the situation in Venezuela, we have to go to sources outside the United States, including news about the role of the U.S. in the problems in Caracas. This was journalist Nathan King's report for China's Global Television Network on Tuesday about the U.S. role in the troubles of Venezuela.
As the future of Venezuela hangs in the balance, the U.S. has been publicly trying to tip the scales. From the U.S. Secretary of State making unsubstantiated claims about Moscow and Maduro.
There are indications that Maduro was prepared to leave and that the Russians asked him not to go.
To explicitly saying the U.S. may use force in Venezuela.
Military action is possible. If that's what's required, that's what the United States will do.
Official after official in the Trump administration has been publicly supporting opposition leader Juan Guaido and challenging governments that support Nicolas Maduro, sometimes using Cold War rhetoric.
I don't say this is an ideological conflict, but this is our hemisphere. It's not where the Russians ought to be interfering. This is a mistake on their part. It's not going to lead to an improvement of relations.
In fact, the U.S. president even tweeted about imposing sanctions on Cuba for its support of Maduro, failing to mention that Cuba has already been under U.S. embargo for 60 years. And in a story reminiscent of the times when the U.S. used to use covert armies to undermine governments across Latin America, the Reuters news agency reported that Eric Prince, the founder of controversial private security firm Blackwater, an advisor to the Trump administration, has been pushing a plan to hire mercenaries to topple Maduro. If that sounds far-fetched, consider that the U.S. president's special envoy for Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, was convicted in the 1990s in connection with his involvement in the Contra rebels scandal. Illegal arms sales to Iran were used to fund a right-wing insurgency against the Nicaraguan government.
Now, here at the White House, they say this is not a case of regime change because Juan Guaido, they recognize, as along with a lot of other Western governments, as the legitimate leader in Venezuela. But reality on the ground is that Nicolas Maduro is still in the presidential palace, is still running the government, still seems to have the loyalty of the army. So whatever they're trying to effect is essentially a change of government. Nathan King, CGTN at the White House.
Meanwhile, something that you won't see get much play in the U.S. is a major mistake made by U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who accused Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro of hiding in a military bunker. As it turns out, while Bolton was making that accusation, Maduro was addressing thousands of people in the streets of Caracas on national television. RT reports that the U.S. portrayal of its horse in the race, Guaido, who was videotaped hanging out of the top of a car, allegedly leading the Venezuelan people to victory, left out the reason that he stayed at least a car's distance between himself and the Venezuelan people after the last time he tried to mingle with the people he says support him. That was back in March when a car escorting the self-proclaimed president was ambushed by citizens, as shown in a YouTube clip. But a brief moment of clarity in U.S. media, as has been happening lately, took place on the Tucker Carlson show on Fox, of all places. Carlson had RT journalist Anya Parampil on to discuss the situation in Venezuela on Tuesday.
Anya Parampil is a reporter who just spent a month in Venezuela reporting from the ground there, and she joins us here in studio. Anya, thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So what do you make of the news coverage of this?
Your viewers won't be shocked to hear this, Tucker, but the news media, the fake news media, are lying about the situation in Venezuela. Let me put it for you this way. Imagine if Hillary Clinton had refused to admit defeat after losing to President Trump in 2016 and banded together a group of 24 U.S. soldiers and attempted to take the White House by force. I don't think she'd be walking freely on the streets the way Juan Guaido is walking right now in Caracas. And I certainly think the news media would be calling it rightfully a coup. And let me just tell you, when it comes to what's happening on the ground there, I can tell you, I was there for a month earlier this year. The opposition has no popular support. Juan Guaido proved today once again that he will only ride in to power on the back of a U.S. tank. And what's more, we hear about a humanitarian crisis there, Tucker, but what we never hear is that is the intended result of U.S. sanctions, which have targeted Venezuela since 2015. Sanctions which, according to a report that was released just last week by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, has led to the deaths of 40,000 Venezuelans and will lead to the deaths of thousands more if these sanctions aren't overturned. President Trump, if he truly cared about the American or the Venezuelan people and the American people for that matter, he would end this disastrous policy, he would end the sanctions, and he would look into John Bolton's eyes, into Elliot Abrams' eyes, and Mike Pompeo's eyes and say, you are fired. You are leading me down a disastrous path, another war for oil, something the president said.
You are passionate.
He was celebrated by the American people when he said Iraq was a mistake, and now he's willing to do it again.
But it is a bipartisan thing. I mean, Biden came out today and said he agrees.
Absolutely, it is a bipartisan issue.
So, it's interesting. It would be interesting to know why that is. I believe in an open debate, and I'm not sure I agree with everything you said, but I'm glad that you could say it here. And you were just there, and I don't think you'd be allowed at any other show to say that.
No, I certainly don't think I
would. You were never out
and
of time.
So I really appreciate opportunity because President Trump promised to drain the swamp, and he flooded his national security team with that exact swamp.
Well, I agree with that, actually. Anya, thank you very
thank
much
you, Tucker.
For your perspective. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Another story that isn't getting much play in the U.S. media is the occupation of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. by a group of Americans who are there to stop a delegation of U.S.-backed diplomats purporting to represent Venezuela from taking the building. Kevin Zeese is one of the organizers of that effort. He's with Popular Resistance, and he's an attorney practicing in and around Washington, D.C. He spoke with Lauren Steiner on her program, The Robust Opposition, on Tuesday, and he says the term occupation, in fact, does not apply.
We don't call it occupying because we're here legally. We are here with the permission of the elected Venezuelan government. We were here for the first few weeks. The effort began on April 10th, and we initially the government had embassy employees here and diplomats, and we started to stay here with them and got to know the place, and they got to know each other and felt comfortable with each other, and we've stayed and they've left, and we've given us a key, and we've been here to, as the Embassy Protection Collective. You can find us on Facebook at Embassy Protection Collective, the Facebook page, and that will give you a list of all the things we're doing. But our purpose is to protect the embassy from intrusion by the U.S. government in order to give it over to their puppet government, Juan Guaido, who is a attempted coup that's failed in Venezuela, and they're trying to prop up with this embassy ploy. The idea is to serve as a protectorate. There's also an embassy in Caracas. The U.S. embassy is vacant. The embassy in Venezuelan embassy in D.C. is vacant. And in Caracas, the United States wants Switzerland to serve as a protectorate. They need the Venezuelan government's permission for that. Venezuela is negotiating with governments to have them serve as a protectorate here, and we hope that the U.S. and Venezuela can negotiate an agreement so that there's no incursion into embassies. Under the Vienna Convention of 1961, the host country, in this case the United States, is required to protect the embassy. It's inviolate. That means it cannot be violated. It can't be trespassed. There can be not any unlawful entry. They can't enter without the permission of the Venezuelan government, the elected Venezuelan government. There's only one Venezuelan government. That's the one led by President Nicolas Maduro. So we hope the two countries can negotiate a settlement for both embassies and that both embassies will be protected. And we're here to serve as interim protectors, the Embassy Protection Collective.
So tell me about some of the activities that you've been having, because I know Medea and other people have been live streaming some of your forums and rallies. Tell us what you've been doing to pass the time.
Yeah, well, we've been doing a lot to pass the time. We're very busy here. Of course, running a collective and a community involves feeding people and keeping the place clean and taking care of the embassy. We see it as a duty to really be responsible for this embassy. So we are keeping it in good shape. We are truly protecting it inside and out. We had an art build early on where we had people come in and join us in creating banners and art displays that we then used to decorate the embassy with. The outside of the embassy is covered with large banners calling for ending the coup, ending the sanctions, no war, and really seeking a peaceful alternative to this threatening situation that the U.S. is creating. We have held nightly forums and cultural events. Forums tonight, for example, we did an event tonight with Pat Elder, who's an activist on the effort to stop the recruitment of youth and high schools. We did an event recently on Julian Assange with Joe Loria, who is the editor of Consortium News. Did an excellent job talking about the Assange case. We did a Black Alliance for Peace, did a night on AFRICOM and how the U.S. has militarized Africa. We had a fantastic night where we talked about the CIA role in regime change with a former CIA agent, John Kiriakou, speaking from the embassy, threatened with coup. He's talking about an insider's view of regime change from a CIA agent. So that was a pretty remarkable thing to be in the Venezuelan embassy talking about how a coup operates from a CIA officer's perspective.
Watch that live stream, but the audio kept going in and out. So I was hoping that you guys just simply videotaped it so that you could run a clean version.
I'm not sure. Well, there were multiple live streams of that one. So we have clean versions of that. We had a big audience that night, more than 100 people. And we've done a lot of events that are musical events as well, Latin music. We had a fantastic DC band come in the other night, did some fantastic spoken word. I'm not sure how to describe it. It's kind of their own creation of a music form, and we've had artists bringing art in. We've had it's a variety, and then we also do rallies outside the embassy. We do protests and rallies outside the embassy. Visibility to show that there is people here who are protecting the embassy. We have to deal sometimes with opposition people who Washington, D.C. doesn't have a lot of Maduro supporters. Most of the Maduro supporters can't afford to leave Venezuela and come to Washington, D.C. They're back in Venezuela. But former government officials, big business folks and their families who came to the United States after Chavez was elected and Maduro stayed in power have come to Washington, D.C. We have some opposition people that we deal with. Small number, not a big deal. And we have security outside, security at the door. It's a very, really carefully run place to really keep this going in a safe way and a responsible way. And we're in contact with the Secret Service. They've come out a few times. I'm the police negotiator, so I meet with them and talk to them, let them know that we're here legally, that we're not trespassing, that we did not unlawfully enter, that we're violating no laws, that we have the permission of the embassy to be here, explain to them there's no reason to arrest us, that they would, if they came in, they'd be violating the Vienna Convention. They still say they're going to come in, but they haven't given us any date yet. We've sought several times that there was a date coming, but we have able to get a large crowd out, and I think that large crowd helped to keep the law enforcement away and decide not to have that messy event of arresting. We've had up to 50, more than 50 people in the embassy, so sleeping over. We don't call it an occupation, we call it a live-in. We're living in the embassy. It's a live-in, not a die-in or a sit-in, a live-in. And it's the Embassy Protection Collective living in to protect the embassy.
Okay, so you made a call for people to come from far and wide.
Yeah.
Where is the farthest that someone has come to protect this embassy? And how are people staying? Are they staying the whole time? Are they coming in and out? Do you have a core group that is holding the embassy?
Right. Well, we've had several Californians come, Lauren.
Well,
we've had several Californians who are staying here. And one who's a regular, who seems to be planning to stay for the duration, although he has some wedding or something in June. So if we stay that long, he'll probably have to go to that. But there's a core group that stays. We have someone come from Berlin, Germany. That's probably the longest trip. We've had people from Chicago and Boston. We've had, so it's a mix. And obviously we come from Baltimore. And so we have a lot of local folks, but also a lot of people from the Philadelphia, tri-state, kind of around the D.C. area, plus as far away as California, Chicago, and Boston.
Now, as far as you know, has this ever happened before in the history of the United States, somebody trying to hold an embassy for the lawful government from illegal takeover?
I don't think it has. At least I'm not aware of it. I've looked to see if anyone wants to research that and let me know. I've researched it and couldn't find any indication of it happening before. And so I think this is a new issue, but it's a really important issue. And if the Trump administration decides to come in and unlawfully arrest us and unlawfully evict us, it would be a terrible message for U.S. foreign policy to say that no foreign embassy in Washington, D.C. is safe. If you disagree with U.S. and don't allow the U.S. to pick a president for your country, and they can take over your embassy, that is a terrible message for the United States to send. I really hope that there are people in the State Department who are thinking very carefully about whether that's the message they want to set. We really hope that rather than sending that message, they talk to Venezuela and resolve how to solve the U.S. Embassy in Caracas, the Venezuelan Embassy in Washington, D.C., put in protectorates from both other countries, and that begins a process of the two countries talking to each other. There's no reason for the U.S. and Venezuela to be at odds. Venezuela has the most oil, most gold, most diamond reserves in the world, most gas, high levels of mineral deposits that are critical for electronics. They have fresh water. The U.S. needs to stop trying to steal that wealth and trade for it, to enter into negotiations. We hope that the resolution of this embassy dispute will start a process of the two countries talking to each other and finding ways to work together rather than to fight each other.
Okay, now my final question to you is, has the mainstream media covered you at all? Because we know that in this instance, the mainstream corporate media is acting as stenographers for the corporate state once again in disseminating the BS about, Maduro being a brutal dictator and his policies causing the humanitarian crisis and his government firing on the protesters and him being elected illegally, all the stuff we covered in the show.
The USA Today has done a story. There's not been a lot of mainstream media, not a lot of corporate media, but we are getting a lot of media telestores here regularly all the time. Various Russian outlets are here regularly. There are some U.S. outlets, but not a lot. They should be covering this. This is really a historic event that should be covered. But the reason they're not covering it is because when they cover it, they have to answer the questions. Is Maduro a Democratic president? Of course he is. We've published a declaration of this protectorate. If you go to Popular Resistance in the slider, popularresistance.org in the slider, you can read our statement. We lay out how Maduro was legally elected. We lay out how the Vienna Convention protects this embassy, and how Guaido was illegally self-chosen. He violated the Venezuelan constitution in multiple ways. And so that's all clear and should be something that if the corporate media covered this, would have to answer those questions.
The problems that can face a society when the media fails was the subject of discussion at a recent panel at the United Nations. A discussion of that topic was called by the Russian Federation and took place on Monday. This was the spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry, Maria Zakharova, as she addressed the attendees.
Thank you so much for participation. Of course, it's not a formal meeting. It's a possibility for us to talk and to have a very good conversation and an honest one about the things which are not only on our common agenda, but which are very serious to each and every country and person in our days. In the run-up to the World Press Freedom Day, I regret to say that the number of violations, both in the area of freedom of media and safety of journalists, remains high. According to the data of specialized organizations, in 2019, over the several months since the beginning of the year, several journalists have died. Besides, in terms of journalist safety, the group of risk includes not only countries with unstable military or political situation, but also the states and the countries that have always been at the forefront of democracy and stability. However, the profession of journalists has historically entailed risks, while media in general is living through an unprecedented crisis nowadays. Almost all that international community has achieved in the information sphere over the recent decades is either ruined or seriously changed now. Everything which is connected to the media area is under transformation and very contradictive. I will be very concrete in my speech. I'll try to pose examples and even more. I'd like to pose questions. It's not to lecture anybody. It's just to have a possibility to gather different opinions on the very serious things. Let's talk about freedom to disseminate information. You recall the famous Watergate, when Deputy Director of FBI Mark Felt leaked the information to journalists and in doing so made this case public. The story turned the domestic political agenda in the United States, which hosts all our family here, upside down. More than that, it influenced information processes on a global scale. In 2017, about 2 years ago, a movie came out under the title Mark Felt, the man who brought down the White House. This movie depicts what this high-ranking official did is a heroic action. Entire generations believe that in this story, media defied lies and defeated hypocrisy. All right, but what do we see today? We're watching prosecution of the founders of WikiLeaks, who in fact did something similar as one of the FBI chiefs. But for some reason, Mark Felt is perceived as a hero, as a person who changed the information world, and actually the world in general. But the WikiLeaks activists are proclaimed criminals. So, we all know that William Shakespeare wrote these outstanding words, to be or not to be. And Vladimir Mayakovsky, who was the Soviet great poet, he said, he proclaimed what is good and what is bad. I think that we should, I think it's a in this paradigm, in of these two statements, of these two big questions, it's a very good and a very right way to talk about media and information in our days. So let's take a look on role of NGOs in protection of journalists. Once non-governmental organization and professional community of journalists used to stand up to protect all who advocated freedom of speech, even if those activists might have break the law. Today, that was actually alpha and omega of information sphere and journalism. Today, we see that NGOs and some representatives of civil society get picky when it comes to protecting journalists. Sometimes it has to do with political motives. One example, recently in London has founded an organization to protect journalists. A great idea. The initiators were a famous human rights activist, Amal Clooney, and the head of the foreign, some governmental structures of Great Britain. They called upon journalists who feel oppressed or persecuted to share with them any relevant information to help them, to assist them, to protect their right. In a couple of days, and ironically, in the same place in London, Julian Assange was arrested, and the newly minted organization never stood up for him. So, what is good, what is bad, to be or not to be? So, let's move to another topic, antagonism inside the journalist community. For decades on end, the world has known the rule of all journalists always speak out to protect each other, no matter what is the race, religion, or nationality of journalists. Today, it is journalists themselves who stand on the opposite sides and actually shoot at one another. I mean, with words, with articles, with the reports. Ironically, this is the president of the German Federation of Journalists, Frank Uberl, who acts as a driver of Crusade versus Russian media outlets in Germany. A few days back, he plainly called for restrictions against, for example, Russia Today Deutsch, Sputnik in Germany. He made several interviews calling for sanctions against the media. My next topic is contradictory initiatives coming from one and the same core. World media experts, including Russians, recently has become part of many initiatives to develop priorities for protection of freedom of speech and countering fake news. For example, the Paris Peace Forum, to have taken place in late 2018. The official Paris did all it could to demonstrate readiness to protect media and freedom of speech, and actually to provide a very nice platform for all of us to talk and to work out some principles to stress the need to protect journalism and freedom of speech and combat fake news. However, it is exactly in France that the government consistently and systematically imposes restrictions on the Russian media. Just one example. Here are a few pieces of statistics to make it clear. Not a single Sputnik Russian news agency journalist out of 9 working in France has received a press card from the French Foreign Ministry. And actually, the card confirms that its holder is an accredited foreign media correspondent. This is the document that gives one the right to work. By the way, this matter has dragged for more than a year now, and the accreditation is not formally denied. There are endless appeals by Russian journalists for which they receive standard answer, the work in progress. All this is insulting for the journalists, actually, who are not given any facts regarding their alleged inappropriate behavior or improper way of conducting professional activities, nothing provided to them as facts. I would like to stress here that this situation actually leaves journalists beyond legal status and does not allow them to engage in their professional activities, effectively work. One more contradiction of today's media world. It's the goal set contradicts the real steps. Yesterday, in a statement I heard made by EU delegation, we heard brilliant words that European Union was committed to freedom, democracy, freedom of speech. We can applaud to such words. Ukraine traditionally joins all statements pronounced by EU. However, it is exactly the Ukraine that situation with media freedom raises the most concern on European continent. For example, Ukrainian authorities have long embarked on the path of systematic repressions against unwanted journalists. The arrest of Kirill Vyshinsky, the editor-in-chief of RIA Novosti Ukraine news portal, who was seized under ridiculous accusations in a fabricated criminal case, has become an apotheosis of this genuinely totalitarian struggle against media. I would like to stress that the Kyiv authorities continue to hold him almost a year in prison, a year without a court verdict. The entire world tries to prevent the spread of fake news. However, its amount is only growing. Day by day, we come to hear someone blaming someone for propaganda without providing any facts to prove the allegations, which makes the accusers real propagandists.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio,
I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.